If you have your Bibles, would you open them to Luke 2? Luke chapter 2. You know, as a kid, I remember thinking about what I was going to be when I grew up. Now, probably you can think back through your life and find a point as a kid where you were wondering, what am I going to be when I grow up? Well, I remember the very first thing that I ever wanted to be was a shortstop for the Baltimore Orioles in the major leagues. And at 7 and 8 years old, I could just envision myself running out of the dugout onto the field, grabbing my glove, fielding those grounders, throwing them over to the bases for the out. You know, for me as a kid, hitting was like no big deal. Everybody else was concerned with home runs. I was all about the fielding. When we got our third out, I was the only one on the bench going, "All right, we're back in the field." Little League for me wasn't just fun. I was training for a career. I knew it. I was born for that for a couple of years anyway, until I got to be about 10, and I decided that now I was going to be a career artist for the Walt Disney Studios. I enjoyed drawing as a kid, and I would draw pages and pages and pages of stuff. And I remember seeing this little snippet of a video before one of the cartoons, and it showed the artist in the studios of Disney drawing away. And I thought to myself, that's what I'm going to be when I grow up. That lasted for a couple of years. Then I got to be 13 or 14. I went into high school and I joined the Air Force ROTC. And that's when I knew my true calling was to be an F-16 fighter pilot for the Air Force. That lasted for a few years until I learned that I'm actually colorblind and you can't be a pilot if you're colorblind. And so that didn't work out either. The closer and closer I got to adulthood, the less and less sure I was about what I actually wanted to do. And the truth is, I wasn't alone. As it turns out, most young people have no idea what they want to do. You talk to a high school senior or a college freshman about what they want to do with their lives, and probably you'll get the same answer, I've no idea what I want to do. In fact, statistically, 1 in 5 college freshmen will start their academic career with the major of undecided because they have no idea what they want to be. On the other hand, some kids never have that problem. They know growing up what they're going to be. Some kids, it's almost decided for them because they know all their life they're going into the family business. My uncle was that way. His dad owns a sawmill down in southern York County here in PA. And all his life growing up, my uncle spent summers and weekends working at the mill, washing logs, helping to fix machinery, doing all these things to help keep that business up and running. And he loved every minute. He loves logs. He loves wood. He loves the sawmill. He loves the dust, getting his hands dirty. He's just that kind of a guy. And so when he graduated high school, that's what he did. He went to work for his dad at the mill, and he's been there for 40 years. He's never had another job. He runs the place now, but he works in and always has been in the family business. Did you know the oldest family business in the United States is the Emery Farms business in New Hampshire? It's actually a timber operation, so it would go very well with the sawmill, but it was founded in 1655. And for the entire 363 years that business has been in operation, it has been under the control of the same family. That business sign never changed. Under new management, never happened. The same family's been running that for 3.5 centuries. But that's nothing. Because the oldest family-run business in the world actually comes from Japan. It's a construction firm, and ever since it was founded in the year, get this, 578 AD, it's been run by the same family. For 72 generations, no kid in that family ever had to ask the question, what am I going to do when I grow up? They went into the family business. Well, when Jesus came to earth, when he was born, you might say that he was born into the family business. And what I mean by that is when Jesus was born, his heavenly Father had already decided his future, his ministry, his vocation, his death. Everything about why he was here was already predetermined. He was here to work for Dad. Jesus later even says in John chapter 6, I've come down from heaven not to do my will, but the will of him who sent me. And that kind of vocational focus affected not only his prayers, but our prayers even to this very day. Because Jesus said, if you remember, when you pray, pray like this. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. It was all about doing the will of the Father. When Jesus came to earth, he came to minister to people, sure, but he came because he was sent. And he was sent by his Father to go into the family business. That's a business of healing. That's a business of restoring, of cleansing, of loving the unlovable. That's a business of caring for the people the world rejects. Jesus told us in Luke 19, the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost. When he's arrested and he's having a conversation with Pontius Pilate, and Pontius Pilate's trying to figure out who he is and what he's all about, it says in John 18, for this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I came into the world, to bear witness to the truth. It was all about service, all about that family business. You see, when Jesus came into the world, he had one mission: to bring anyone and everyone possible into an eternal saving relationship with the Creator of heaven and earth. And here in Luke chapter 2, we get to see that begin. We get to see Jesus pick up the mantle of that responsibility and go to work for his Father. And we get to see that starting in verse 41, where it says, now his parents went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of the Passover. And when he was 12 years old, they went up according to custom. And when the feast was ended, as they were returning, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem. His parents did not know it, but supposing him to be in the group, they went a day's journey, but then they began to search for him among their relatives and acquaintances. And when they did not find him, they returned to Jerusalem searching for him. After 3 days, they found him in the temple, sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. And all who heard him were amazed at his understanding and answers. And when his parents saw him, they were astonished. And his mother said to him, son, why have you treated us so? Behold, your father and I have been searching for you in great distress. And he said to them, why are you looking for me? Did you not know that I must be in my father's house? And they did not understand the saying that he spoke to them. And he went down with them and came to Nazareth and was submissive to them. And his mother treasured up all these things in her heart. And Jesus increased in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man. Back in 2008, at the Beijing Olympics, a swimmer by the name of Michael Phelps, you remember that name, shocked the world when he became the most decorated Olympic champion of all time. And even though Michael Phelps only competed in one sport, he is considered to be the most successful Olympic athlete in the history of the Olympic Games. And right away, as soon as he started winning medal after medal and gold after gold, and the national anthem of the U.S. kept being played over and over, the sports commentators started making notes. And they started saying, well, you know, proportionately speaking, Michael Phelps has longer arms than normal people. And so he can swim a little bit faster because he can move the water a little bit better. And proportionately, his legs are a little bit shorter. And his torso is hydrodynamically shaped in such a way that he just kind of glides through the water like a fish. And they started saying, you know, this kid was born to swim. He's built for it. This is his calling in life. And it was an impressive thing to see Michael Phelps go through that water. I'll never forget it. And if you've ever had the opportunity of watching somebody who's talented and called to do something and gifted at doing something do that very thing, it's an impressive thing to watch. One of the things I like to see are those street artists. You know what I mean? They've got a couple cans of spray paint, some old paint cans and coffee cans and a piece of paper and like some toothpicks. And they just spray stuff. And by the time they're done, it is a masterpiece. Quite an impressive thing to watch. Well, one of the things that we notice about Jesus here in our passage is that ministry isn't just what he did. Ministry was who he was. Ministry was what he was called to do. It's why he was born. He was born to love on people. Notice he says in verse 49 at the very end, "Did you not know that I must be in my Father's house?" You know, other versions of the Bible, like the New King James, for example, puts that verse this way, "I must be about my Father's business." And literally, if you go back to the Greek language, what it's talking about is my Father's will, my Father's affairs. I'm here to do the work of my Heavenly Father. And it gives us a very interesting picture of somebody who possibly for the very first time in his human life, discovering what it is that he's been called to do. You should understand that it is widely believed among theological scholars that Jesus intentionally hid from himself the calling on his life until right now. And that he did it so, as it says in verse 52, he could grow in wisdom and in stature and in favor. But here we see him discovering that spiritual calling that God placed on his life. When I went into ministry, I remember telling my parents about it and telling them how I was going to give up the job that I had, which was fairly decent in pay at least, and I was going into ministry, and I'll never forget their response because they were shocked. And not in a good kind of way, but in a we can't believe it kind of way. In a when are you going to get a real job kind of a way. That's not a real career. That's not what real people do. That's head in the clouds kind of stuff. They just couldn't understand in their minds why I would choose something like this. And I explained, this isn't a choice. This is a calling. It isn't like I woke up one day and said, you know, I'm tired of this job. I'm going to go be a pastor now. That looks fun. I can work an hour a week. I get that question a lot. Hey, pastor, when can I get a job where I work an hour a week? Well, I'll tell you when I find it. But that's not how it goes. Psalm 37 says, "Delight yourself in the law of the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart." You know what that does not mean? That God will give you what you really, really want. And I hear that all the time. Well, you really want something, just ask the Lord. And if you hope and hope and hope and hope really, really hard, he'll give it to you because it says right there. That's not what that means. What that means is he'll give you the desire. He'll make you want the things that he wants for your life. And when God places that desire on a person's heart, let me tell you, it doesn't matter what it is. It doesn't matter what he's called you to do. It doesn't matter how large or small it may seem. If he's put that desire on your heart, nothing else in this life will ever satisfy. I knew a farmer in Ohio who dealt with this very thing. I was in his combine one time. His name was Kevin. And we were taking the corn down off this 100-acre field. And I was driving down the rows with him. And I said, "Hey, Kevin, why is it that you would pick farming of all things? I mean, the market is very unstable. You never know if your crops are going to come in. It's all weather dependent. You have almost no control over success or failure. Why would you pick farming? Why would anyone pick farming?" And it was like he was waiting for the question. Because without missing a beat, he looked out over the hood of that combine. We were facing west. This was in the evening. Looking out over all these rows of corn and miles of different cornfields and bean fields. And the sun was setting. And he said, "Look at that. Could you imagine anything better than that?" He was called to be a farmer. And let me just say that one of the best parts of being a believer, one of the best and most exciting parts of having a personal relationship with the God of the heavens and the earth, a God with a creative power that he could just make the Rocky Mountains and the Northern Lights over Alaska and Hawaii and the oceans that in some parts are so deep mankind has never found the bottom. and a universe so big that it can't even be measured, that a God with all of that creative power, one of the best parts of being a believer is understanding he used all of that creativity when he made you. He harnessed it all, and he put it into each and every person. You were built for a reason. You were created for a purpose, and that purpose is as unique to you as your fingerprint. And as believers, one of the most exciting things we have is to discover what that is. I like what Proverbs 25, verse 2 says. It's the glory of God to conceal things, but the glory of mankind to search them out. And so each one of us has a calling on our life. Each one of us has a spiritual calling that God has put there, a desire to do something. But you know, figuring that out can be somewhat tricky, at least for me. Notice what Jesus does in verse 46. After 3 days, they found him in the temple, sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. You see, when Jesus learned his calling and he discovered what he was here to do, notice what he goes and does. He goes to the leaders of his church. He goes to the spiritual leaders in his community, his elders, his pastors. And he sits down with them and he learns about God and he learns about the law and what it means to serve the Lord. He learns all about how that calling is going to affect his life. Now, they weren't perfect, but he cared enough about it to go check it out. You know, too often when people feel the Lord has called them to do something, they do one of two things. One, they either take it and run with it without checking with anyone or asking anyone's advice. They just go. Or two, they don't do anything. They struggle with it. They wrestle with it. They never figure it out. And let me say that both are wrong. We're not called to do either one of those things because that's not what we see Jesus doing. He went to the elders. He went to somebody for help. He went and sought guidance. And let me say that you, as members of this church, are blessed. And I don't say that lightly, but you have a terrific group of elders in this church. And I meet with them, and they are men who love the Lord. They love his church. They love his word. They love his people. And they would love to help you when you come to these times in life where you're just not sure what God is doing. Now, they might not have all the answers, but they would love to walk that road with you. If you're wondering who your elders are, you can open up your directory. They're listed on the front page. Any one of them will be able to help you in this journey. And so the first thing we notice about this journey, this family business that Jesus goes into, is it's a spiritual calling. Second, it requires devotional commitment. Notice what it says in verse 52. And Jesus increased in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and man. I've shared with you before that growing up, I was not the best student. I'm not at all the one that you want to point to and look at my transcript. I barely passed. And I mean, I passed because they rounded up some decimal points and kicked me out of the school. It was that kind of a graduation. The problem was I wasn't committed. You know, my mom used to always tell me that if I put half as much effort into actually doing my work as I put into not doing my work, that I'd have had straight A's and more time to spare than I'd have known what to do with. But I wasn't committed. I wasn't devoted. And that's because devotion and commitment take sacrifice. It means I would have had to give up some other stuff, and I would have had to give my undivided attention to my schoolwork and not my friends or sports or whatever extracurricular activities we were doing. But I'd have to focus on that singular thing. No distractions. There was a concert pianist who, after her concert, was approached by a reporter that asked her, "Why is it you're so good?" And she said, "Well, you know, naturally, I'm not good. What it takes is intentional neglect." And he looked at her and said, "What do you mean intentional neglect?" And she said, "I have made the commitment to intentionally neglect anything and everything that doesn't make me better on the piano." That's devotion. That's what it means to be totally 100% committed to something. And here we see that right after Jesus discovers his spiritual calling, he intentionally neglects anything that isn't part of God's plan for his life. And you should know that did come at a cost in his life. He neglected physical comfort. He neglected popularity. He neglected good treatment of people around him. He was ridiculed by all kinds of people. He even says in Matthew chapter 8, foxes have holes and birds have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. He intentionally neglected anything that didn't bring him closer and closer to his Father. And you should know that when we grow in our faith, when we commit ourselves to the Lord, that's a calling of intentional neglect. That's a calling to get rid of anything in our lives that might draw us away. That's what it means, by the way, when Jesus says in Luke 9, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. You know, I hear a lot of people quote that verse and think it means personal struggle. It doesn't. That verse is talking about giving up personal ambition for the sake of what God has planned in our life. And so his plan becomes more than just something we begrudgingly go along with. And, oh, this is God's plan, I guess. It goes from being that to something that we embrace and that we run with and that we grab hold of. You can't pick up anything without grabbing hold of it. And you can't make God's plan part of your life without making it personal. And here we see Jesus committing himself to God's plan for his life. And that plan, by the way, says that he was called to be a lamb for us, so that we would be called lights for him. Jesus said in Matthew 5, you're the light of the world. Let your light shine before others so they would see your good works and give glory to your Father. That's what we're called to do. And so whatever personal plan God has for your life, and believe me, he has one. There is also a general plan that he has for the entire church. All believers, all Christians everywhere, and that's a plan to shine his light into the world. You know, but doing that takes devotion. It takes commitment. It takes intentionally neglecting the stuff that might pull us away. And that means dedicating our lives to growing our faith, growing closer to the Lord, ridding ourselves of things that pull us astray, being on the lookout for those things and taking appropriate action, making our light brighter, making our light clearer and more powerful, so that when people look into your lives, you know what they see? They see a God that is actually as special as you claim he is. Well, Jesus is doing that very thing. He's committed himself to growing in the Lord. Verse 52, and Jesus increased in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man. So there's a spiritual calling. There's devotional commitment. Third, there's faithful confidence. Notice verse 47. And all who heard him were amazed at his understanding and his answers. Verse 49 again. Did you not know that I must be in my Father's house? You know, in all of the Bible, these are the first recorded words of Jesus Christ. Did you notice how confident they were? Did you notice how there's no doubt of whether or not God is at work? There's no doubt that God has a plan, just the faithful confidence that there is the plan and a commitment and devotion to go find it and to live it out. I've always liked what Proverbs 3 says, trust in the Lord with all your heart, and he will make straight your paths. Because this reminds me, and that verse reminds me, that no matter what we go through in life, you have a God that's in control. No matter what that plan means or how confusing it might be, you have a God that's in control. Now, I don't know about you, but I've observed in my life, I get in the most trouble when I forget that. When I set God's plan aside and I try to do things on my own. When I give up on his plan and I make my own instead because maybe his is too hard or seems impossible or I don't understand all the parts. And I say, okay, I'll figure it out on my own. More trouble follows that singular decision than any other decision anyone will make. And if you've been a Christian for more than, we'll say, 10 minutes, you've probably already figured out that God's plan is still going to happen. All that decision does is delay the blessing that plan has for our lives. You remember Abraham. If you attend our Wednesday night Bible study service, then you know Abraham well, because we've been looking at that guy for weeks and weeks and weeks. Abraham was the man in Genesis that God said, "You'll have more descendants, Abraham, than there are stars in the sky or grains of sand on the earth." And you remember the song, "Father Abraham had many sons had father." You know the song. That's him. But the thing is, when God made that promise to Abraham, him and his wife were both well beyond those childbearing years. And so they doubted. And he didn't get a son right away. And instead, they come up with this idea where Abraham will have an extramarital affair with Sarah's servant, a woman named Hagar. And from that relationship, that extramarital affair, he will have a son whose name is Ishmael. And as soon as Ishmael comes around, it's like Abraham goes back to God saying, "God, look what I did." He says in Genesis 17, "Oh, that Ishmael might live before you." In other words, "Lord, we saw that it wasn't going to actually work with Sarah the way you said, but don't worry, we've got your back. I figured it out, and I have a son. His name is Ishmael. Let's use him instead." And God responds, "No, but Sarah, your wife, will have a son, and you shall call his name Isaac." You see, Abraham giving up on God's plan and picking up his own didn't change God's plan. All it did was delay the blessing, because it would be 25 more years until Isaac was born. You see, if God is calling you to do something, and he is, he's called you to something very special. No matter how unlikely that may seem or how impossible that may seem, let me encourage you to have faithful confidence in that plan, because we have a God that Jesus said, "With mankind, this is impossible, sure, but with God, all things are possible." And here we see Jesus do that very thing. Just imagine that for a minute. Being a young boy, 12 years old, discovering possibly for the first time in your entire life that your heavenly Father has already mapped out your entire future, and it ends on a cross on a mountain called Calvary. Imagine being 12 years old and figuring that out. And yet notice what he says in verse 49, "I must be." I don't have any other alternative. There's no other calling on my life. There's nothing else I can do. I must be in my Father's house. I must be doing my Father's will. But that brings up one last point as we close. Confidence in God's plan does not preclude confusion about God's plan. In other words, just because you have confidence doesn't mean you'll always understand what's going on. I like the way his parents responded. This is Mary and Joseph, verse 50. "And they did not understand the saying that he spoke to them." Now, Mary had an advantage, because if you remember, Mary was visited by an angel named Gabriel who mapped out for her everything that was going to happen. It happened one chapter ago here in Luke, where he says, "He will be great and will be called the Son of the Most High, and he will reign over the house of Jacob forever." She had a personally delivered message from the angel of God himself. And then here in verse 49, Jesus says, "I'm going about my Father's business." And so Mary had kind of an advantage to understanding this plan, and yet she still didn't get it. You see, not understanding doesn't mean you have a lack of faith. Not understanding all the details doesn't mean you're a bad Christian. In fact, I would tell you that it's only in the understanding that faith can even exist. Hebrews 11 says, "Faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen." And so confidence doesn't preclude confusion, but neither does confusion prevent confidence. Instead, we have a faithful confidence. We have a confidence in the truth that we have a God who can do things we can't even imagine. And his plan for your life is there. And he's called you to do something very special. You see, no person was ever created as a decoration. Think about that for a minute. There's more than 7.5 billion people right now that live on planet Earth. Not one of them is a decoration. Not one of them is an accident. Not one of them is an extra. Not one of them is just a space holder. But every single person who has ever lived has been created for a reason. You were created for a reason. There is a spiritual calling on your life. And that calling includes you being part of the family of God. And if you are part of the family of God today, then understand you have been called to the family business.